All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got a packed show today, so I'm just going to rush right through the intro. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Ralph Schoenemann, someone who's been a staunch fighter in defense of Lynn Stewart, radical people's attorney, revolutionary attorney, Lynn Stewart, who's now basically jammed up in a federal prison down in Texas, and she's being slowly murdered, okay? We're going to talk about what's happening in Lynn's case and the recent developments with her, something that everybody should stay tuned for. In the middle of the show, we're going to be talking about Black Against Empire, the history and politics of the Black Panther Party, a comprehensive overview and analysis of the history and politics of the Panthers, and it's helping to reveal the explosive growth of the revolutionary movement of the 1960s in a way that it hasn't really been brought out before. We're going to be talking with Joshua Bloom, one of the co-authors of that book. But opening the show up, I'm really proud to welcome to the show Stephen Bright. On March 18th, 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court decided that Gideon versus Wainwright, the case of Gideon versus Wainwright, they held that all criminal defendants have the right to a lawyer. But 50 years later, something just ain't going right. Something's just not adding up. And it's a far cry from whatever promise was initially made. And Stephen Bright is here to talk with us about this. Steve is president and senior counsel for the Southern Center for Human Rights and a lecturer at Yale Law School. He's also been a fierce opponent of capital punishment for many, many years and has appeared twice before the Supreme Court. And he recently co-authored an article which really caught my attention. It was called 50 Years of Defiance and Resistance After Gideon versus Wainwright. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Sure. Good to hear you, man. This article is really just a stunner. So I want to jump into it. 50 years ago, as I said, the Supreme Court's decision, Gideon versus Wainwright, supposedly guaranteed every defendant in the U.S. court system the right to an attorney regardless of circumstances. This is supposed to be a hallmark of the U.S. judicial system. Stepping back after 50 years, how's that working, man?
Well, it's not working very well. As we say in the article, every day in thousands of courtrooms all across the country, the right to counsel or the right to a lawyer is being violated. Courts are having proceedings and even taking guilty pleas and sentencing people who don't have lawyers at all. Many people have lawyers only in the pretense of having them. That is, they meet a lawyer, plead guilty, get sentenced, and the lawyer doesn't really do anything other than convey the plea offer to the person, but is not in a position to give them any advice. And the most tragic thing, of course, is that we see cases that are important cases that are going to trial with people who have people who are innocent, and this system, which is mostly a system of pleas, almost all criminal cases are resolved with guilty pleas. This indigent defense system, this system for defending poor people accused of crimes, is not prepared to conduct trials, to investigate, to retain expert witnesses, and do what's needed. And that's why innocent people are convicted and sent to prison, and the perpetrators of those crimes remain at large.
Well, let's give people some numbers and some examples, because that was pretty stunning. And one of the things that comes out repeatedly in your paper, the examples that you give and the numbers. I mean, for instance, people might say, look, okay, you know, everybody knows, you know, and it's sort of one of those everybody knows things, right? You know, you see it on TV all the time. You have the right to an attorney, and if you can't afford one, one will be provided for you. And all this thing, don't talk unless you see your attorney. Always insist on an attorney. But you've revealed some very stunning facts that I think are important for people to know in terms of numbers and in terms of what actually happens to people. I mean, people being kept in jail without ever seeing an attorney, sometimes for longer than they could even be sentenced for if they were convicted.
Well, that's right. And one of the things the court said when it decided the case, March 18th of 1963, is that this was to make the process fair, that people had a right to a lawyer, but also that this was to make everyone equal before the law, the notion that all people are treated equally. Well, the first breakdown of that we see is when somebody's arrested. A person who has money is going to have a lawyer and is going to be out of jail within 24 hours, except in an extraordinary case if they've just done something beyond the pale. A poor person may be arrested and may languish in jail for weeks or months before ever seeing a lawyer. The critical nature of that is that, you know, you lose your job, you lose your home, your life falls apart. It may be that at the end of that time, the charges are dismissed. The person may never be convicted of anything. In fact, one example we use in the article is a woman who was arrested in New York. Her husband was on dialysis, and because she could not make bail and didn't have a lawyer to seek her release, she was unable to take her husband to dialysis, and he died. Ultimately, the charges were dismissed. So she was never, ever in her whole life found guilty of any crime, but it's hard to imagine any more severe punishment than what she suffered as a result of being detained prior to her trial.
Now, how do they get away with this thing of people just not having lawyers and being held in jail? How do they get away with that, man?
I think the court must have naively thought in 1963 that if it said the Constitution of the United States requires the states, and I should make this point, 95% of the people in prison are sent there by the state courts, not by the federal courts, but by the state courts. And basically, I think the court thought the states would follow its decision. The truth of the matter is, a lot of these states, 1963 was 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education, many states were in open defiance of the Supreme Court's decision in Brown, and many were and are to this day in defiance of its decision on the right to a lawyer, just simply have not funded it. And when you think about it, that's not surprising. The government, which is interested in convicting people and sending them to prison or fining them or executing them, has no incentive to provide lawyers, which will defeat those goals. In fact, it's quite the reverse. The worse the lawyers provided to those accused are, the better chance the government has of obtaining its conviction and obtaining death sentence in capital cases.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Steve Bright. Steve is the president and senior counsel for the Southern Center for Human Rights and then a lecturer at Yale Law School, and we're talking about his recent piece called 50 Years of Defiance and Resistance After Gideon versus Wainwright and the supposed right of everyone to have an attorney when they're thrown into the criminal justice system. Steve, you know, one of the things in terms of your title, the 50 Years of Defiance and Resistance, you know, one of the things that really just sort of jumped out at me is you also make the point that a lot of this is very conscious on the part of, for instance, prosecutors, and that even in terms of denying the poor an adequate defense is a strategy that's used by some prosecutors to win cases. And then there's things where, you know, you talked about the role of economic status and race come in, and the whole question of how that plays out in terms of people's economic status, even beyond their ability to pay for an attorney, but even the idea that if somebody says, I want an attorney, suddenly they're hit with fees that they can't pay, so they don't get an attorney. What about all that?
Well, one of the things many states have now, anywhere from $50 to $200, to apply for a public defender. And so some poor people will come into court. Almost nobody has the money in their pocket when they're arrested or when they come to court. So a lot of times they're only told, well, if you want a lawyer, you'll have to pay $50 or $75 or whatever the state charges to apply. They're not told that they have a constitutional right to a lawyer. They're not told that the fee can be waived. And many people, not being able to pay the fee, will just simply not, you know, say, well, I don't have the money, so I'll represent myself, which is in any kind of case, even the most minor kind of case, they're all sort of pitfalls for the unwary. I mean, the reason people hire lawyers is because you need for lawyers to tell you things like, if you plead guilty to this charge, you'll be deported, even though it seems like a minor charge. Or if you plead guilty to this charge, you will be able to live in public housing, or you'll never be eligible for public benefits, or you'll never be able to get a license to be, you know, a nurse or a hairdresser even. I mean, there are all these consequences that flow from being convicted, even of the most minor crime, and people who don't know any better will plead guilty and not realize that they're going to suffer these consequences.
You know, it's amazing when you're talking about that because you're thinking about how many times people go, you know, you get thrown into a courtroom setting, you get thrown into jail, you get thrown into a courtroom setting, you're there by yourself. Maybe you've never been there before, maybe you've been there a couple times and you're more jaded, but all the time you're actually, you know, you're in over your head, you're in something that you don't quite know all the ins and outs of and what the rules all are and everything else. And then you have these prosecutors come and really, I mean, this point about pleading and, you know, meet them and plead them, that the whole way that the court system is run. And then you have the prosecutors coming and offering people or telling people all these outs that they can have, which would mean actually that they're going to make an incredibly bad decision generally that would be, you know, that could basically determine the course of the rest of their lives. This is a fairly heavy thing and something that's supposed to be, you know, this equality before the law.
Well, and we point out there's not an adversary system. I mean, you know, the idea is that the prosecutor prosecutes aggressively and the person has a defense lawyer to represent them zealously, and so it balances out. But when you don't have lawyers, or you have a lawyer for 5 minutes, what you really have is the prosecutor has all the power. The prosecutor decides what plea offer to make, what to tell the defendant, can really dictate the sentence as well as the conviction. And so what we really have is sort of an inquisitional system where the prosecutor is the inquisitor. But the problem is, because the prosecutor is an adversary, he or she is not looking out for the best interests of the defendant. The goal, of course, is to get people to plead guilty and fine them or imprison them. And very often there's no interest on the part of the prosecutor to tell them some of the other consequences that will happen if they enter a plea of guilty. And I ought to say, this meet 'em and plead 'em, and by that I mean, you go to a courthouse or and all these people, it looks like a slave ship is docked outside the courthouse, all these black men handcuffed together in orange jumpsuits brought in. A lawyer will go down the line. Of course, these are not confidential communications because everybody, if you're handcuffed to a person on either side of you, everyone can hear the conversation. And the lawyer will to all those people. And then a short time later, the judge will take the bench and they'll all plead guilty and be sentenced. And then there'll be other people coming out of the free world. In some of the courts that I see, the judge will say to those people, now you can either talk to the prosecutor or you can talk to the public defender, without suggesting there's any reason you'd be more likely to talk to one than the other. And many of the people talk to the prosecutor and enter guilty pleas without any advice from the defense lawyers at all. But even those that line up behind the defense lawyer table, behind the public defender, there are 40 people. And so, you know, within 2 hours, they're all going to have pled guilty or continued their case. Now, when this is going on, everybody knows. Everybody, the judge who's presiding, the prosecutor who's prosecuting, all of those people know that this is a farce and a mockery of any right to a lawyer. These people are not represented. They're just being processed through the system, like you're at a fast food restaurant. And it really is fast food justice, and it's no justice at all.
You know, it's really important. Actually, I was going to ask you about this adversarial versus inquisitorial system, because one of the points that you made that I thought was really, really important is that the most powerful person in the courtroom is actually the prosecutor, not the judge, not the defense attorney, right, not the defendant, but the prosecutor. Let's talk about that a little. And
absolutely,
what difference that makes.
I mean, we have in this country in the last, 20, 30 years have moved so much power from the judges to the prosecutors that now the prosecutor, in most criminal cases, the only investigation that's done is done by the law enforcement and the prosecution. The prosecution has access to the crime laboratories and so forth. We know they're not very reliable because the National Academy of Science has told us that, you know, the science is often compromised in order to serve the purpose of prosecution in those places. They're really part of the police departments. The prosecutor decides what to charge, what plea offer to offer. Has the ability to really slam the person if they don't take the offer. I mean, the death penalty being the ultimate example of it, the prosecutor says to someone, I just was talking about a case in Alabama, you can plead guilty and get 8 or 9 years in prison, and if you don't, we're going to seek the death penalty. And the person says, well, I'm not guilty, so I'm not going to plead guilty. And, of course, anybody's going to think, well, you better think twice, because you could get the death penalty. Now, the prosecution obviously doesn't think this case merits the death penalty, or he wouldn't be offering 8 or 9 years in prison. I mean, he's not even asking for life in prison. He's saying, I will feel that justice is done if this person gets 8 or 9 years in prison. But when the person turns the offer down, the prosecutor follows through on his threat and obtains the death penalty. The person is very poorly represented by some hack lawyer, and now the person's under death sentence. And you see that in all other sorts of, one of the examples we gave was a Supreme Court case where the guy had written a bad check for $88, and the prosecution said, unless you plead guilty and take 5 years, I'm going to file repeat offender papers, and you'll serve life in prison. This is over an $88 check, and Paul Hayes, the person there, said, no, I'm not going to plead. That 5 years is too serious a sentence for an $88 check, which, of course, it was. But the prosecutor filed the papers and sentenced him to life in prison. The judge had no choice. Once the prosecutor filed those papers, once he was convicted, there was no choice. And that's true today with the in a lot of regards with the federal sentencing guidelines. That's true in the state courts with the mandatory minimums. I mean, the prosecutor, by charging and plea bargaining, really dictates the sentence that's ultimately imposed in many cases, not 100%, but in many cases, a tremendous, the most powerful person in the system by far is the prosecutor. And that person is almost completely unaccountable. There's no such thing as recovering money if you were maliciously prosecuted. Prosecutors have absolute immunity for anything that they do as prosecutors, hiding evidence, refusing to turn over evidence that shows the person may not be guilty. Those things happen all the time. Cases get reversed, perhaps, if you find out. Of course, most of the time you don't find out. But nothing ever happens to the prosecutors. Nothing ever happens. It's quite remarkable. Of course, many prosecutors are honest people who go about their job in a professional and good way, but there's certainly, particularly in the state courts where the prosecutors are elected, we see a lot of really bad misconduct, and yet there's no one. The judge in the case can't hold the prosecutor accountable. The Bar Association doesn't. You would think in a system of checks and balances that we would have some check on the discretion of the prosecutor, but there really is none. It's quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you tuned in to the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Stephen Bright. He's the president and senior counsel for the Southern Center for Human Rights and a lecturer at Yale Law School, and we're talking about the situation. Well, we're talking about his article, 50 Years of Defiance and Resistance After Gideon versus Wainwright, and the supposed guarantee everyone has of having the right to an attorney when they're dragged into the U.S. court system. Now, Steve, one of the things, we have about 6 minutes. I have two more questions. This always happens. I have so many more questions. I want to talk about this. You mentioned that, you know, there's both the public defenders. When people get attorneys, there's the public defender's office, and then there's court-appointed attorneys. A lot of times it is a question of just like being severely overworked. I mean, I saw this film up at Sundance called Gideon's Army, which, you know, was a very powerful film in terms of when you look at what the life of a public defender is, the caseload that they have, all this other stuff. And that's, I wanted to ask you about that in relation to this question. But then also the idea that, you know, that a lot of these attorneys, I mean, you in your article, you guys point out a number of things where you're talking about attorneys that are dead drunk the night before and they're, you know, they come into court, they're not prepared, all this stuff. And there's a question of actually the incompetence of a lot of attorneys that become court-appointed attorneys. Let's talk about those two things in relation to this.
Well, public defenders, many are outstanding. Many are dedicated people that are well-trained and supervised. But, of course, if you give people more work than it's humanly possible to do, then it can't be done. There are public defenders in this country carrying 500 cases at one time. Well, it's impossible to represent 500 people at one time. I don't care what they're charged with. You just can't do it. And that's because of underfunding. That's because the states and those places have not provided sufficient funding to hire enough public defenders that each public defender can have a reasonable caseload. With regard to court-appointed lawyers, you have the same problem. If you're not paying very much, you'll end up getting the absolute dregs of the legal profession, which is what you have in a place like Houston, where there have been three death penalty cases where lawyers slept during the penalty, during at some point of the capital trial. One of those people's been executed. That's not to say that happens in every case, but if that's happening in any case, it tells you something about the quality of lawyers that are being appointed. There's a lawyer right now practicing law in Houston, Texas, who missed the deadline for filing in three different death penalty cases to get the client's case reviewed in the federal court. I mean, he should have been suspended or disbarred after the first time, but nothing happened. After the second time, nothing happened. The third time, nothing happened. I mean, this meant the clients had no review by federal judges of their conviction and death sentences. And yet right now, today, that lawyer's handling over 350 cases in Houston, and at least three of those cases are death penalty cases. Now, any system that cared about justice would not allow that lawyer to be handling any criminal cases. And yet, that's what we've settled for.
Well, let's talk about this, the Strickland versus Washington decision, which seems to be right along the lines of what you're talking about, the fact that they set an outrageous new standard for judging whether the right to an attorney is more than just a formality, and that is incompetent yet constitutionally adequate.
Right. And the two things the court did there, One, they said, we will strongly presume that the lawyer is competent. No matter how hopelessly incompetent the lawyer is, the starting point of any analysis is you presume the lawyer is competent. And no matter how clueless the lawyer is, you presume that every decision made was a tactical or strategic decision, that it was a professional decision made by the lawyer in the exercise of professional judgments. Both those things are preposterous in most criminal cases. But then finally, the court said, even if under this very low standard that it set, a court finds the lawyer was deficient, failed to do something that he or she should have done, which is usually investigate the case or do any preparation, but may also be just totally incompetent during the trial, the courts can still uphold the conviction if they conclude that it didn't make that big a difference. So we have appellate courts looking at these cases and saying, well, yeah, the lawyer, no question, he was drunk or he was asleep or he was this, that, and the other, but we don't think it made any difference. So we've really substituted trial by judge for trial by lawyer. I mean, there's no way that judges could know whether it made a difference or not. They didn't see the witnesses. They weren't part of the jury. They don't know how the case was assessed by the jury. And yet, when the courts say that it didn't make any difference, they deny the claim of ineffective lawyer. So people say, well, the lawyer wasn't ineffective. That's not true. The lawyer was ineffective. It's just that a group of judges decided it didn't make any difference. So it's a very almost dishonest way of hiding some of the incompetence that takes place in these cases.
You know, and I can't help but wonder, Steve, too, that the idea that, you know, especially when you put this in the context of the mass incarceration that's going on today, the 2.2 million people, and half of them being blacks and Latinos, poverty being a big factor, all those people in jail, and the many millions more who are somehow under the charge of the justice system. You put that all together, and I can't help thinking what an outrageous, outrageous assault this is on the humanity of a whole section of people in this society. Just incredible, and one that cannot be, you know, just ignored.
Well, and the basic point of this is looking at the dignity of every human being that comes into the court system. I mean, everyone, as you were alluding to earlier, coming into the courts is like being dropped into a foreign land. People are speaking a language you don't understand. Everything's moving very fast. People need a lawyer, an advocate, to explain things to them, to help them make decisions. And then if we're going to send, we've got 2.2, as you said, people in prisons and jails. We've got another 7 or 8 million who are under correctional control, either on probation or parole. At least if we're going to sentence these people, there's got to be some sorting out. So there has to be individual decision-making about the sentences we impose. And yet judges are sentencing people without knowing anything about them, because their lawyers don't know anything about them, and so they're not told anything. So the person may be intellectually disabled, profoundly mentally ill, may have a number of factors that suggest that they could do very well in the community and don't have to be sent to prison. None of those things are ever brought to the judge's attention in many cases, in many places in this country. And so that's why we have this terrible over mass incarceration and the tremendous racism that we see from start to finish, from when police officers stop people driving while black or stop people for loitering, standing around while black or Latino, all the way to the more severe sentencing at the other end of the process. And this is really not even challenged in the court system.
And on that note, Steve,
of course, almost all the people coming through are poor. So this is affecting, you know, there's some white-collar people coming in the federal courts and occasionally in the state courts, but for the most part, if you go down to a criminal court any day, the vast, overwhelming 90% of the people down there are going to be poor, and that means they can't afford a lawyer, and they are just going to be processed through the system. Not everywhere, but in a number of places.
All right, Steve, on that note, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here, and thank you for having me.
Sure, and talk to you again soon. Keep in touch with us about different things that you're working on. It'd be really good. All right?
We will.
Okay, man. Thanks
a
lot.
Thank you.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Stephen Bright, president and senior counsel for the Southern Center for Human Rights and a lecturer at Yale Law School, and we've been talking about his recent piece on the gutting of the right of people to an attorney when they go into court. What's it actually mean in reality? Not very much. It means that a lot of people, a whole lot of people being shuffled through the system right smack into jail. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Joshua Bloom about his new book, Black Against Empire, the history and politics of the Black Panther Party. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. Something's in the air. That's how I felt after reading my next guest's book. It reminded me of all that stuff when I actually lived there, lived in that time, and felt, yeah, something is in the air. Revolution's in the air. And joining us now to talk about that period, and in particular, a very important aspect of it, the Black Panther Party, is Joshua Bloom. Joshua is a fellow at the Ralph J. Bunche Center at UCLA and the collection editor of the Black Panther newspaper collection. He's also the co-author with Waldo E. Martin Jr. of a really important new book, Black Against Empire, the History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning.
Sure. Joshua or Josh?
Either way is fine.
Well, save us a little time if I say Josh, okay?
Yeah, Josh is fine in conversation.
Okay. What I wanted to ask you about first is like, and first I have to tell you that this book, I mean, I sat down and read this thing in like 3.5 days. I had to force myself to put it down. It is such a powerful book and such a unique book. And one of the things that I really appreciated about it was the fact that, as you say in the introduction, it was done as a political history. That one of the things that you wanted to do was, you know, well, you wanted to actually make a political history of the Panthers, which, well, that's it. I'll ask you why.
Well, you know, the party has had a fair amount of attention. There's been not only memoirs, but people have written different aspects and pieces of the history. But it's really been hard to make sense of what the politics of the party was. And, you know, it's sort of a puzzle. I mean, you know, it's always hard to figure out histories. But why has there been so much attention, and why for such an organization that was so important and so formative in the late 60s and into the early 70s, why hasn't anyone really, you know, figured out and sat down and really worked through the politics of the party? And, you know, I think there's a lot of causes, and it's complicated. But, you know, a lot of what's been written has really been obfuscation and mystification. And a lot of that comes directly out of the repressive effort to not only attack and repress the party as an organization, but really to obscure and complicate its history.
Well, isn't it part and parcel, maybe even the leading edge of a lot of the attempt to actually rewrite the entire history of the 60s? I mean, it's phenomenal the kinds of things that are just suddenly reversed. Everything is reversed. Suddenly everything, if you were living there or you were even in that time period and you were honest and you followed what was going on, if you look at a lot of the stories that are told today, the histories, the films, all these things, the idea that people really weren't serious, they were just out for a joyride, that everybody was an opportunist. You get a very different sense in your book, and that's what I really appreciate about it in terms of it taking on the political history of the party, of the Black Panther Party, because it's actually something that shows you how these folks developed, why they developed, what was the need for them. And you talk about one thing. You say that what set the BPP apart was that the emergence of the Panthers in many ways marked a break with most of what preceded it in the Black movement and in the whole movement as overall. Let's talk about that a little, because that's sort of the thing about what set them apart with their politics, which actually did entail a break with a lot of what had gone before it and a lot of other things that were out there at the same time.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you read a book like, you know, Hugh Pearson's Shadow of the Panther, which was recognized as one of the most important books of the year by the New York Times in 1994, it basically takes the politics out of the party, right? And it looks at, you know, sort of what is all the sort of criminal allegations that we can either find or dig up or create, right? A lot of it's not very well substantiated. But, you know, this kind of attempt to criminalization was really a key part of, you know, Hoover's thinking, you know, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, very explicitly, you know, talking about, you know, the real threat of not only the armed self-defense, but the breakfast programs and the service programs, specifically because they reached to broader alliances. So what we were really trying to figure out is why does the Black Panther Party in a revolutionary politics and a politics that's so distinct from civil rights politics that, you know, you think about the success of the civil rights movement in the early 60s at really dismantling Jim Crow and its claims for participation in America, and it's turn the other cheek nonviolence, and it's, you know, civil disobedience, sort of bodily challenging, but in a very nonviolent, very explicitly nonviolent way. Jim Crow and formal caste subordination. Why at the height of the success of the civil rights movement do you get a real sea change, really, and the emergence in the late 60s of the Black Panther Party really becoming the center of Black freedom struggle and Black insurgent mobilization, where people are saying, you know, no, we don't want to be a part of America. We need to overthrow America. And in fact, we need to be able to govern our own communities. And in part, we're going to have to take up guns and do that through an armed revolutionary process. So really trying to make sense of why this distinct politics has become so powerful in the late 60s.
Well, it's really interesting, too, because, you know, part of the thing is, you know, when you look at this, this point that you just alluded to, the point of a lot of the civil rights organizations, the whole movement, was really much more about we're going to participate in America. We want our full participation in America. And yet what the Panthers came out, and this separated them off not just from the civil rights movement, but also from a lot of the other organizations that were out there and trends that were out there in the world at that time. It set them apart in the sense of they said, look, we don't accept the legitimacy. The very idea of the legitimacy of the U.S. government and the U.S. system is, no, sorry, we're not going for it. That was a pretty heavy sea change there.
Absolutely. And, you know, you think about the moment and there's really a change that happens leading up to the formation of the Black Panther Party with the call for Black power. And it really is like this question, you know, and I was surprised when we started going through the archives and even just looking at some of the organizations that Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were working with at Oakland, but same in LA. If you look at the organizations in LA around the Black Congress, or if you look at what was happening in New York or Chicago or other major cities throughout the country with large Black populations, people had seen the civil rights movement. They had seen the power of people standing up to change their circumstances. They'd seen the success of Black freedom struggle, but they hadn't been able to really make inroads into challenging poverty, into challenging ghettoization in the cities. You know, you had had these major growth of Black communities in the North and the West and urbanization. And, you know, those jobs that had drawn people in World War II had left with white flight, and the municipalities had responded basically through containment policing. And so, yeah, the Black Panther Party was part of a range of organizations that were asking, how do we build Black power? How do we build political and economic power that really addresses those conditions in the city? And they were not the only ones to sort of take this revolutionary stance. You know, they were in many ways building on organizations like the Revolutionary Action Movement that had taken a very similar anti-imperialist position and said, we need to challenge, you know, the imperialist power in the United States and create our own forms of governance. But they took those ideas and made them into a practical politics that was really powerful in a way like nothing else in that period.
I want to talk about that, but first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Joshua Bloom, who's the co-author of The Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party, and it's put out by the University of California Press, Berkeley. Really remarkable book. I would really suggest everybody get this book, man. It's like you're going to learn so much, and you know, put so much in perspective in a certain way. And I think even the framework for the 60s is people are reminded of what the framework actually was, you know, and that's one of the things I thought was really important. And I want to sort of pursue that line of thought. But starting with the point that you just made that, look, what in 1968, in early 1968, you make this point repeatedly throughout the book. In early 1968, the Panthers were still a sort of an organization on the block. They were in Oakland. They were small. They had some influence in Oakland. But there was something just in a little while, in a matter of months, their membership mushroomed. And in a lot of ways, they were put in a position they never expected to be in. You know, they became the most serious challenge to the whole U.S. empire that ever existed, probably. You know, and the thing is that they had, I don't know, this point you just said about it was partly a question of their ideas, but it was more than their ideas. It was what they actually did in the context, in the face of the conditions that they faced, the actual ideas and the implementation of those ideas. Let's talk about that and the difference that that made for people.
Well, you know, you can have an idea about sort of the problems of the state and the problems of imperialism, but that's very different than moving people. And what the Black Panther Party did, there were a number of people asking these questions in different ways, but they figured out ways of actually building the power through disruption by making business as usual impossible. How do you tap that power of disruption? How do you do it in a way that really speaks to people's heart, where they're at, and can sustain a source of power to build movement? You know, we think of sort of developmental organizing, and there's all kinds of people, you know, all the time who are really going out there and building networks and building organization. And that's really important work. And there was a lot of that in the Black Panther Party as well. But when we look at movements like the civil rights movement or like the revolutionary black nationalism and the Black Panther Party in the late 60s, or you think of industrial unionism in the 1930s, or, you know, you name your movement. A lot of times the real power for mobilization comes out of tapping the power of disruption. People who don't have necessarily institutionalized power to change things to address their interests within the society as it's established, oftentimes are able to really make a change by making business as usual impossible. And the question is, how do you sustain that kind of challenge? And what Huey Newton and Bobby Seale did on a very local level, first in Oakland, was that they recognized that there was power in the resistance and the frustration and the anger of poor and working class blacks in resistance to police brutality. And they really saw that confrontation of young black people to police as a potential political force. And they were looking at the Watts Rebellion and other rebellions that were going on. And they said, we need to figure out how to tap that. So it wasn't just the idea of revolution and the idea of anti-imperialism and Malcolm X's idea of the black community and self-determination and, you know, we're going to be the stewards of the black community. It was, how do we connect that to what people are really experiencing on the street, and how do we build power? And so what they started to do, and they took notes and in some ways copied the Community Alert Patrol down here in L.A. that was built after the Watts Rebellions, they started patrolling the police, but doing it with arms. So that instead of having their tape recorders and their cameras snatched and, you know, taken away by the police, they were able to actually confront the police in these public environments in front of Merritt College, at the airport in San Francisco, in front of the Ramparts office. They had a series of confrontations with the police in these public spaces where they were armed, and they were able to actually back the police down because they were following the law. And they knew the letter of the law, and they knew how to act, and they knew how to read the situation, and were able to actually have these confrontations and stand up to the police. And people saw that on a local level, and they were like, wow, this is power. This is something. And so they built a small following. Now, it was still pretty little. I don't know how much detail you want me to go through in these stages. There were a lot of different stages that the party went through where there were changes. You know, the state of California, you know, pretty soon you have hundreds of black people rallying on the streets in Richmond in response to the murder of Denzel Dowell, a young black man, where people are coming to the Panther rally and bringing their own guns, hundreds of people on the street corner and saying, this is our corner. You know, the police don't rule here anymore, right? And all of a sudden, the state of California says, well, we better change the law, right? So they go into the state assembly. Now it's national news. So people have heard about, by February of 68, when the second office opens in LA, people have heard of the Black Panther Party, SNCC, which was certainly one of the leading, but probably the most influential organization mobilizing direct action in the civil rights movement. They're looking for ways to be relevant post-civil rights. And so they're exploring a merger with the Black Panther Party. They've heard about what happened in Sacramento. They've heard about what happened in Richmond. They're trying to figure out, how do we build black power? So February 68, an office opens in LA. But what really changes things and you know, sort of puts the Panthers at the center of black politics is the assassination of Martin Luther King. And all the, you know, young people in these cities throughout the country who have been saying, how do we build black power? And have been looking what the Panthers are doing in Oakland and then in California are like, okay, you know, the nonviolence and claims for participation just are not going to do what it takes. And so very quickly, you have dozens of cities by the end of the year that open up Panther offices with hundreds of members in most of those cities dedicating their lives to the revolution.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Bloom, one of the co-authors of the book Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party, and that comes from the University of California, Berkeley Press, all right? So check that book out. Now, Joshua, really important point, because people don't really even get that today, that people were actually dedicating their lives to the revolution that they saw as real. And it was real, you know, in a very important sense. And I think actually one of the things, too, that I wanted to explore, because the Panthers had such a broad impact in society, it's sort of like a living example of the whole idea that when revolution has its day, the people think a whole different way. The influence that the Panthers had broadly, I mean, something I didn't even realize was the influence the Panthers had on the radicalization of the student movement. Really, really important. And not just black students, but white students, all, you know, the whole student movement, the idea that anti-draft activism was actually the way people should be going, that one of the important things people should be taking up, if they're saying they're anti-imperialist, which was one old struggle, then if you are and you want to stand with the people of the world, you have to be against the draft, you know, or otherwise you're complicit in a certain sense. So it was really, really remarkable, the influence the Panthers had in society as a whole and what that did to change the whole climate in the country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that, you know, there's all this talk about framing and frame alignment and sort of the power of ideas and how you have to talk to the moment. And I think that sometimes there's a way that people get the causal relationship backwards, that ideas are very important, but ideas alone, they need some kind of grounding in real politics to be able to move people. And so you had people talking revolution from, you know, in trying to organize in black communities from, you know, very early in the 60s and, you know, and earlier, of course, but on some significant level with the Revolutionary Action Movement from the early 60s. And it wasn't really moving people. And what happened was that when the party really was able to situate itself really at this juncture where you have broad, moderate black political organizations who, organizations like the NAACP and the Urban League even, who, while they very much do not support Black Panthers' politics and their revolutionary vision, also are completely frustrated with, you know, the high incarceration rates of young black people, the lack of access to higher education, the lack of employment by the government. You look at fire departments and police departments in predominantly black neighborhoods and cities, and they were all white during that period. Very little incorporation into the democratic local machines, let alone federal representation. Only six congressmen, you know, at the time that the party was starting, only six congressmen nationally, black congressmen, had ever been, you know, sort of elected at one time. So you have a situation where moderate black political organizations aren't getting what they need. At the same time, and this is really crucial, right? The Vietnam War, right, is pretty unpopular already, and people don't understand why they've got to go fight and be drafted and die for this war, right? And yet you look at 1966, right, and as late as 66, there's very little draft resistance. You have these little pockets, right? But it hasn't taken off on the campuses. And it's actually not the Panthers, it's Stokely Carmichael and SNCC that say, hey, if you all want to be relevant, you know, and they're talking to SDS very specifically, and SDS isn't that big at this point. If you want to be relevant, you have to start resisting the draft. And that's where people are really going to listen to you. And what black revolutionary nationalism and anti-imperialism gives to a broader anti-draft movement is it gives some very local, real legitimacy, right? It's one thing to say, oh, we don't want to go fight in this war because we don't want to die. That's traitorous, right? And there were people who were, you know, being jailed and also beaten on the streets, right, for these kinds of positions, certainly, you know, in the Korean War and in World War II, but also in the beginning of the Vietnam War. But what happens is with the black movement moving towards an anti-imperialist position and really the Panthers galvanizing that, this politics becomes a real reference point. And people who are, you know, not wanting to go and fight this war can say, hey, I'm anti-imperialist too, because, you know, you look at the Democrats, right, at that period, 68, right, the Democratic Convention, 80% of Democrats vote to end the war and end the draft, right? But what does the party machine do? It pushes through a pro-war platform and a pro-war candidate.
What?
Right?
The Democrats?
The Democrats, right? The Democratic Party, right? They're not listening to the constituency, right? And so this anti-imperialist position really becomes a way for people to have a political voice. And it's through that practical politics. It's by creating a political position which can draw support that the ideas shift. Revolution as an idea becomes real because it has power in the street.
Let me ask you this, and this is going, I'm going to combine two questions here. And one of the things your book does an excellent job of detailing the unparalleled repression that the Panthers came up with. And before I get into that, let me remind people again that I'm talking with Joshua Bloom, who is one of the co-authors of Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party from the University of California Press, Berkeley, a really remarkable book, an important book. Make sure you don't miss it, all right? Pick it up and read it. Now, Josh, one of the things that we're going to have to combine these questions, and there's so much to talk about in here. Maybe we'll have you back some other time, but the international reach, all this other stuff that goes on. But you also mention in the book the unparalleled repression of the party. And you say something that I think is extremely important, and it ties into this whole thematic thing that we've had going on here. You say that that repression was not just against the Panthers for its practical thing, but for the promise it held for millions of people about a different kind of future. I think that's extremely important. And in particular, the whole idea of something else you mentioned at the in your conclusion of the book is that while you can't say whether something else would have happened if the Panthers didn't happen, what you can say is that without the Black Panther Party, we would now live in a very different world. Can you talk to both of those things at once?
Yeah. So, I mean, on the first point, right? I mean, Hoover's clear about this, right? I mean, you look at the memos internal to the FBI, and again, it wasn't just Hoover, right? We now have the Watergate tapes, and we can, you know, we see Nixon telling, you know, Hoover, you know, and Mitchell that we got to go after the Black Panther Party. But the approach was very clearly, we have to vilify this party and we have to drive a wedge between the party and its potential allies. The San Francisco special agent in charge of the FBI wrote a memo to Hoover and says, look, we shouldn't be going after the Breakfast for Children program. It has the support of white liberals and the black church and all these points. And Hoover's very clear. He says, look, you're exactly missing the point. That's why we need to go after the program. We need to make this a political impossibility, right? You had a second question. What was your second question?
My second question is the point that you made, that the world would be a very different place without the BPP having been around.
Right. You know, and it's hard. It's hard to sort of separate all the very complex historical causalities and really in a precise way say what would have happened. But here are some things that we do know. We know that the draft was repealed and the war rolled back. We know that we got affirmative action programs. We know that we got the growth of black electoral representation, not only on a local level, but nationally. We know that there was a vast expansion of the black middle class. We know that many of these institutional responses clearly were not just responses to the Black Panther Party, but they very much were responses to a broad social destabilization in the period. And the Panthers were in many ways at the heart of that. They were not the only organization, but they were a key organization and a key part of a broad challenge to American power and imperialism as constituted. And I think we can't really understand where we are today without a draft, with large, you know, it was not during the civil rights movement, you know, that people want affirmative action and access to higher education and electoral representation, right? There's tons of problems that persist. Mm-hmm. There's tons of problems that persist, but there were some real substantive changes that happened in that period.
All right, Josh, and those problems that persist to me, actually because we weren't able to go all the way back then, that's what we really, really need to do now, is to seriously take up this whole question of revolution, nothing less, to solve the problems in this society and the world, actually. Joshua, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. All right. And the book is Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party. It's from University of California Press, Berkeley. Josh, thank you very much for both an interesting discussion and a really compelling and important book. All right.
Thank you.
Take care now. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Ralph Shulman about Lynn Stewart and what's going on with her isolated down in prison in Fort Worth, Texas. So stay tuned.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand?
All right, welcome back. And that's Joe Cocker with A Little Help From My Friends. And I thought that was really important for our next conversation now. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time introducing it because we have limited time and it's really important to get this out. I really want to welcome to the show Ralph Schoeman. Ralph is a man who has been fighting against imperialism. It seems like most of his life, when I read what he had done, I was like, wow, this is a cat I really want to talk to on a lot of levels. But he's also someone who is actively advocating for the well-being and for people to come out and support Lynn Stewart, revolutionary people's lawyer Lynn Stewart, and the killing confines she's facing in federal prison in Fort Worth, Texas. Ralph, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Let's jump into this, man. What is the situation with Lynn Stewart now? This is somebody that I think everybody needs to know what's going on and needs to step out and do something around. So let's. What's up with Lynn?
Well, as you were indicating, Lynn Stewart is a heroic figure, really. She's a celebrated attorney for the most disadvantaged and the most oppressed. And indeed, she was required by the federal courts to defend prisoners, or rather defendants, I should say, that no one else would defend. And that occurred with respect to the blind Egyptian cleric Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman when he was being charged with the so-called Landmarks Plot, which entails the presumptive plan to blow up the Statue of Liberty, the George Washington Bridge, the Lincoln Tunnel, the Holland Tunnel, the United Nations building, to assassinate the then Secretary General of the UN, Boutros Ghali, and then Senator Alphonse D'Amato. And try to picture this. Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, an elderly, blind, indigent, diabetic figure, whose diabetic condition is such that he had no sensation in his fingertips and therefore couldn't read Braille. He doesn't speak English. He has two impoverished walk-up mosques, one in Brooklyn and one in New Jersey, and he caters to young immigrant kids who are dishwashers and taxi drivers. His whole interest is in Egypt. He's an Egyptian Muslim fundamentalist who is in opposition to the Mubarak regime. He has vanishing little involvement with things within the United States per se. Now comes an Egyptian intelligence operative named Ahmed Ali Salem, Mubarak's operative, who operates from the FBI
Ralph,
New York.
We have talked about this. I appreciate the detail you're going into, but we have really limited time, and I don't want people to miss the chance to hear what is happening with Lynn now. Lynn was convicted, wrongfully convicted, framed up, convicted, sentenced to 28 months at first, and then got out of jail and was resentenced to 10 years in jail and ended up down in Fort Worth, Texas in a federal pen.
That's very well said and synopsized. But why do you think that this persecution and prosecution unfolds? Mm-hmm. Because the evidence with respect to the Sheikh's innocence go right to the role of the United States government and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And that's what induces John Ashcroft to fly into New York to the David Letterman show and assimilate Lynn Stewart to the putative crimes of the person she's defending.
Right, exactly.
And the thrust of this is to say that any lawyer who defends a person demonized or targeted by the state, particularly with respect to the war on terror, will now be charged with the very offense that they're defending their clients against.
Okay, Ralph, we have 2 minutes, all right? So we actually have to get this. You have a petition around Lynn. Lynn is suffering from cancer. Her cancer has resurfaced.
Lynn Stewart was railroaded into prison under these conditions. She was her bail was revoked while she had a scheduled surgery. He had breast cancer that was in remission. The surgery was denied for 18 months. The cancer metastasized to her lungs, her spine, her lymph nodes, stage 4 cancer. She is shackled when she is taken in for what passes for medical attention. She is the most eligible figure for what is called compassionate release. The Bureau of Prisons does not want to acknowledge the obligation under the 1984 statute for compassionate release. They construe this to mean that you release somebody into a box. But in fact, it's the opposite. Even the New York Times on December 8th of last year editorialized that over a space of 20 years, 220,000 people who were eligible because they had grave illness that could not be administered in prison were and the
the statute calls for their compassionate release under such conditions. New York Times excoriated the Bureau of Prisons for, in fact, doing the opposite of that, holding them until they're ready to be released into a box. That's what's at issue here, saving the life of Lynn Stewart, who they're attempting to convert this punitive sentence into a death sentence by both Justice Department and Bureau of Prisons design.
Very well put.
An international petition to save her life. Desmond Tutu, Dick Gregory, who's refusing all solid food until she's released. 8,000 people have come on board. You have a broad variety of prominent people involved with human rights, civil rights, and above all, defending the right to an attorney and preventing the absolute abrogation of basic fundamental due process, First, Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendment rights that are at stake here in Lynn Stewart's situation.
So, all right, Ralph, and
we ask people to go to the website, lynnstewart.org, sign on to the international petition. Please sign it. Get five people you know to do the same. Each of those to get another five. In five stages, you reach 3,000. This is an emergent campaign to save Lynn Stewart's life, and those are the stakes.
All right, Ralph, thank you very much. I'm sorry the time was so short, but I really wanted to get into that last part.
Because yes, you're right, and
extremely
I appreciate
it. Sure, thank you, man. And we'll have you back again soon. We'll be following this case dramatically a lot. And go to lynnstewart.org if you want to sign the petition. Very important to stand with Lynn Stewart, a people's lawyer like very few others. Ralph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. All right, and just a reminder, that's lynnstewart.org, and you spell Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E, and Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, lynnstewart.org. All right, once again, that brings us to the close of another show, but before we go, there's a couple of things I want to get into. One, first and foremost, thinking about today's show, the whole theme of today's show, this comment from Bob Avakian was something I think we all need to think about, hear and think about, all right? So let's get down to it. Let's get down to basics. We need a revolution. Anything else in the final analysis is bull. That's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's taken from his book, Basics. So you can check that out at revcom.us. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of my guests today, Steve Bright, Joshua Bloom, and Ralph Schoenman. And send out our love to Lynn Stewart. And last but not least, I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me around, and not in a creepy way, you can do that through Facebook and Twitter. And we're going to go out now with another song from the Jefferson Airplane. It's one that used to send me out the door each and every day when I was much, much younger. Not in spirit, but physically, all right? And it's Volunteers from the Jefferson Airplane. Talk to you again next week.